Well, hello and welcome to the Weber Training Teleclass VRE Outbreaks and What I Learned in Kindergarten. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague and the co-founder of this teleclass program, Dr. Syed Sattar, I will say that it is an honor to have you all back with us again. And if this is your first teleclass, a special welcome to you. Our speaker today is Dr. Dick Zoutman. He is a professor of pathology and of community health and epidemiology at Queen's University School of Medicine. He also practices internal medicine and is the director of the infection control program at Kingston General Hospital. If you don't know that facility, it is a very large teaching hospital in Kingston, Ontario. When I first met Dick Zoutman, he was working to bring some semblance of order to hospitals in Pristina, Kosovo, following their war. Those efforts resulted in dramatically cleaner and more clinically efficient facilities. They've saved many hundreds of lives, and he has received wide acclaim for it. And besides providing guidance on infection control and public health to the Canadian government and the Ontario government, he frequently responds to requests for his time and his considerable talent from agencies worldwide, including India, Australia, and various others. He has spoken at a great many conferences and is always very popular. Dick has also produced many fascinating articles that are well worth the read if you do a little Google search and find them. There's some fabulous ones on the cost of infection control that I really enjoyed very much. This man seems to have a boundless supply of energy, and I'm glad that we could harness some of it for our teleclass today. So from Queen's University to give the teleclass VRE Outbreaks and What I Learned in Kindergarten, my colleague and friend, Dr. Dick Zoutman. Dick.
Thank you very much, Paul, and welcome to everyone. I don't know how many of you remember your first day in kindergarten. I remember it vividly. It was a very special occasion, and I'm going to try to relate to what I've learned during a significant VRE outbreak event in our hospital over the last year to perhaps some of the very basic things that we all need to know what we learned in kindergarten. When we speak of vancomycin resistance, of course, we're talking about enterococci, which are normal bowel bacteria in most mammals. They acquire vancomycin resistance through genetic mutation, and we'll talk more about that. But vancomycin binds to a residue, dialanine residue on the peptoglycan of a bacteria that allows the bacteria to cross-link and knit up their cell wall. So vancomycin interferes with cell wall synthesis. The mutated strains that carry the vancomycin resistance, of course, have an alternate pathway in creating this dialanine residue in the peptidoglycan. And so that diala, as we call it, doesn't exist, and vancomycin gets frustrated and can't bind, and the bacteria able to blissfully grow despite vancomycin molecules trying to convince them otherwise. There are many different types of glycopeptide or vancomycin-resistant enterococci. They are characterized by letters of the alphabet and by van A, B, C, D, and so forth. Vancomycin A and, or van A and van B are the most prevalent forms, but they are also slightly different. The van A resistance type glycopeptide is characterized by a unique acquired inducibility resistance to both vancomycin and a related drug known as teicoplanin. This resistance is mediated by a jumping gene. That's a little piece of DNA that can hop from one bacteria to the other, or from between different spots on chromosomes and so forth, known as a transposon, or TN1546. TN1546, this little piece of DNA, is really quite potent. It contains the van A gene cluster, a bunch of genes clustered together that encode for 8 polypeptides that make a bacteria resistant to vancomycin. This transposon can be located either on plasmids, little circles of extra DNA floating around the bacterial cell, or on the main chromosome. And the transfer of these vancomycin A resistance from E. fecalis to Staphylococcus aureus using the jumping gene TN1546 has also been described. That should give you chills. But that means we could create a killer Staph aureus that would be vancomycin resistant, although this is not the mechanism of the few cases of vancomycin resistant Staph aureus described to date. It is biologically possible. The next slide describes the vancomycin A operon, which is the genetic unit that makes a bacteria resistant to vancomycin, and I'm not going to go through it in detail, but you can see it's a highly organized genetic locus on the transposon that codes for the different steps that the bacteria has to go through to make itself thoroughly resistant to vancomycin. Now, vancomycin or van B resistance is similar to van A resistance, but it's not as nasty in that the isolates tend to be susceptible to teicoplanin, that related drug to vancomycin, and as well, the level of resistance is lower. Still means you can't use vancomycin. It's still a VRE, but it tends to be different. And however, the consequences and epidemiologic significance is still about the same. Now, what do we know about the general epidemiology of VRE? Well, it's not a new thing. It's been around over 20 years. We know that it causes colonization, lives in people's bowels, and we do a culture and we find it, and it may persist for many weeks, months, even years in chronically ill people. Of course, it is those individuals who have it in their bowel that have it in large numbers, and this is, of course, how it spreads. Within the hospital environment, widespread colonization of your patient population may occur. However, only a few actually go on to have a documented infection, most commonly a bloodstream infection or perhaps a wound infection. So for that reason, of course, we track colonization with VRE through actively seeking out who's colonized by taking rectal cultures on patients in our hospitals using different strategies that we'll talk about later to chase this bug through the hospital. Now, colonization means that you have to be susceptible and exposed. With respect to exposure to VRE, the most important considerations, as I'll show you, are proximity and the duration of your exposure to other people with VRE. If nobody in the hospital had VRE, we wouldn't have an issue. When the proportion of people colonized on a particular unit, area of the hospital, or even the entire hospital, is very high, for example, about 50% or higher, then actually the classic risk factors for acquiring VRE, that is being ill, being on antibiotics, matter less because there's just so much VRE around, it literally spreads to everyone. The classic susceptible hosts at risk for VRE are those who are severely ill with multiple comorbidities, those who've been receiving multiple and particularly prolonged courses of antibiotics. Colonizations in these individuals often occurs in long-term care facilities and in urban referral teaching hospitals. In particular, solid organ transplant patients, particularly liver transplant patients, and hematology patients, those with leukemia, those getting a stem cell transplant, are particularly at increased risk for colonization. And when you consider the growth industry in stem cell transplantation as a miraculous form of therapy, this is a great concern. Interestingly and parenthetically, healthcare workers and even their household members have been shown to themselves become colonized with VRE, but most of those are healthy people and it would be transient. I want to introduce you to a super species known as clonal complex 17 or CC17. There have been very interesting insights into the population structure of Ephesium obtained by molecular typing data, looking at the genetic makeup of different strains. And this points towards a host specificity of Enterococcus faecium and the existence of a distinct subpopulation that you could call a super subspecies designated clonal complex 17 that's based on a technique known as multi-locus sequence typing, where you sequence seven genes within the genome of the bacteria in a consistent way. And we have discovered then that we have a particular clone that I want to talk to you more about. This clone is globally dispersed. It's a organism fit for hospital invasion. It has been found in many countries that I've listed, and I'm sure I've missed countries, and particularly of interest to myself and many of us in Canada, it's in Canada. this organism demonstrates adaptive diversification. Epidemiologic and population biological studies have shown the existence of this very fit subpopulation. Clonal complex 17 is specifically adapted and built for the hospital environment. It's a hospital specialist. It's an example of adaptive diversification, where the Enterococcus lineage has split into different lineages, resulting in significant ecological interactions and selective pressure. Clonal complex 17, therefore, can be viewed as a new species. Studies of enterococcal genetic material reveal huge diversity and what we call plasticity, the capacity to alter its genetic structure in E. faecalis and E. faecium. Human genetic plasticity, while it exists, is at a much slower scale. Bacteria multiply in 20 minutes, so their capacity to adapt to their new environment is profound. There are significant differences in the genetic contents between the clonal complex 17 E. faeciums and other isolates. As I say, this is an adapted organism built for hospitals. And Dean suggests even to scientific taxonomists that this now satisfies the criteria of being a distinct subspecies. It's distinct from the animal-associated E. faecium. Remember that E. faecium colonizes the bowel of many mammals. It's acquired glycopeptide resistance through what is known as horizontal gene transfer, the sharing of genetic material between bacteria, not unlike how we would share computer programs between ourselves. The emergence of clonal complex 17 E. faecium coincides with an increase in the number of E. faecium nosocomial infections relative to those caused by E. faecalis. In other words, we have seen more VREs among all our enterococci, and within those, the clonal complex 17 is leading the path. And I've given you some references of some wonderful research papers that you may find very interesting. This organism demonstrates substantial ecological success in the hospital environment that is in part, and I emphasize in part, related to antibiotic resistance. Obviously, it's vancomycin resistant, so exposure to vancomycin doesn't bother it in the least. Ampicillin and quinolone resistance are also associated with this, and so again, patients exposed to quinolones, for example, are at increased risk. But antibiotic exposure, folks, isn't the whole story. We used to think, well, this is all because we're giving too many antibiotics on one end, and this organism has been selective pressure is resulting in more VRE. It isn't quite that simple. Bacteria are much too smart. The enterococcal surface protein gene, known as ESP, is a virulence gene contained on the pathogenicity island and is also linked to clonal complex 17. What we have is a VRE hospital clade. A clade is a group of organisms that are all from the same genetic lineage. They're all cousins. A recent comparative genomic analysis of 97 isolates from a whole variety of ecological and evolutionary backgrounds using a variety of different genetic techniques demonstrated that hospital-associated CC117 isolates are genetically very related, and they are grouped together into what is described as a hospital clade, a group of organisms that are specifically designing themselves to infect patients in hospitals, and they are distinct from those in the rest of the human community and in animal isolates. Folks, we have a hospital-specific strain that's causing our problem. Now, the movie Species is a bit of a cult movie from the image I'm showing you there, but it's not dissimilar in relation to what I'm talking about. Microarray data with genetic analysis demonstrates that the clonal complex-specific genes include not only antibiotic resistance genes, but also various virulence genes, various metabolic pathways, and so forth that allow it to be very fit and able to multiply and grow and infect patients in the hospital setting. When I speak of horizontal gene transfer, I'm talking really about three biological mechanisms that I'll just briefly touch on. Transformation is the event when a bacteria dies, releases its DNA and its plasmids, which are floating free in the environment, and that a recipient bacteria can literally suck up this free DNA and use it at will. Transduction in the lower right corner of this slide is where a virus that infects bacteria will actually carry a genetic element into a new bacteria and inject it, sort of like a virus infection. And finally, there's bacterial sex, known as conjugation, where the bacteria actually use what is known as a sex pilus to connect and inject the DNA from one plasmid to the other. Thus, when you look at the clonal complex 17, there's a set of more than 100 enriched genes that are not clustered on one genetic region. That means that the CC117 has over 100 different genes that are unique and specific to it that are not as frequently found in other non-hospital isolates. This implies that it's acquired all of these 100 different genetic elements in a progressive, stepwise manner that's been pivotal for its progression as an ephesium designed to causing infections in hospitals. Multi-locus sequence testing and microarray data, and these are genetic methods to look at the genetic composition of these organisms and of ephesium and ephicus, clearly demonstrate the capacity of enterococci to have changes in their genetic structure and to have broad diversity. This allows their survival and their persistence in environments that otherwise wouldn't allow them to persist. The transmission of vancomycin-resistant enterococcus, again, occurs through this horizontal gene transfer, and it most likely occurs where? Well, the root of all evil, folks, the gastrointestinal tract, which is a gigantic microbial incubator that all of us have. And this implies that there's co-colonization of a vancomycin-resistant strain with a vancomycin-susceptible acceptor strain, and that horizontal gene transfer is happening in all of our bowels as we speak. That might just give you cramps. I apologize for that. Transfer of the Van A and Van B genetic elements in vivo, that is in the living situation, has been documented in the intestine, both of mice and in human volunteers. And Dahl et al., in this lovely paper in 2007, demonstrated that this horizontal gene transfer of vancomycin-resistance genes occurs, and this is important, without selective antimicrobial pressure, and is linked to plasmid maintenance systems, and that occurs at high frequencies. And I'm going to talk more about without selective antimicrobial pressure now. Selective pressure, you know, that's put an antibiotic into the situation, you'll select for a resistant strain. However, as I said before, that's not the whole story. These bacteria are even smarter than that. There's a mechanism called selective persistence. The bacteria have devised a way, without being exposed to antibiotic, to selectively grow in the environment and favor VRE. They are able to persist in the absence of glycopeptide antibiotics, and that is what we're seeing clinically. Van A elements are on these mobile genetic elements, and they are linked, and not lined to, but linked to a post-segregational killing plasmid addiction system. Sounds a bit technical. It's actually not that difficult. These specific plasmids carrying the vancomycin resistant encodes not only for vancomycin resistance, but a bacterial toxin and a bacterial antitoxin that neutralizes the toxin. So if you're a bacteria, you're an enterococcus, and you carry this VRE plasmid and the toxin and the antitoxin, sure, you're making a toxin that's kind of suicide, but you make the antitoxin to protect yourself, therefore you can just carry on. However, if you lose that plasmid, then the antitoxin, which you know is unstable and is degraded and results in the toxin-mediated killing of any of the plasmid-free so-called daughter cells. In other words, this doesn't require vancomycin. It's built into the bacterial reproductive system. It's selective persistence. Very smart. You've got to love these bacteria. They are very intelligent. This creates a replication advantage for those that contain the VRE plasmid. And this is found ubiquitously and physically linked to the VRE elements, the Van A elements. And they have been found also in VRE isolates in poultry in Norway up to 8 years after they banned the use of avoparsin, a veterinary vancomycin equivalent, and resides on the same plasmid as the Van A element. In other words, these selective persistence mechanisms exist not only in the hospital strains, but also strains outside of the hospital sector. Just a pretty picture of bacterial conjugation. Now, away from all that genetic discussion for a moment, you can see, oh, this is a slightly older slide, you can see the vector direction of VRE throughout the American ICUs has been up, up, and up, to the extent that they have seen up to a third of all of their enterococci are vancomycin resistant. Hemodialysis patients in U.S. surveys have been found to have a 10% prevalence of vancomycin colonization. And again, a multi-center study by Street et al. Demonstrates 28% of the enterococci in 25 North American ICUs are resistant to vancomycin, in a study published in 2004. In Europe, using the European Antimicrobial Resistance Surveillance System, or EARS, in 2007, they had 10 countries where the colonization rate or the percentage of VRE was above 5%, three countries had prevalence rates above 10%, and five above 25% of all of their isolates being VRE. Thus, in Europe, it appears they're following the same vector as has occurred in the U.S. with perhaps a one-decade delay. And you can see this demonstrated in this graph taken from the EARS program that's online. In Canada, we have surveillance that is ongoing for VRE. I have data available from the Canadian Nosocomial Infection Surveillance Program that I'm proud to be a member of to 2004. And there's over 2,100 isolates identified, of which most are VAN-A ephesium. Interesting, the clinical infection rate overall is about 7.6%. The range is between 1 and 7.6%, depending on what the definitions are. And you can see that up to 2004, the percentage of enterococci that are VRE is pushing 2.5%. And, of course, we have every reason to expect it's increased beyond that. And based on number of admissions, again, we're running up to 7 per 10,000 patient admissions. This data is current to 2004. And the geographical distribution, you can see, is focused on Ontario and Alberta. And again, the number of VRE isolates per 100 enterococci by region favor Western Canada a bit at the time when the data was done, and Central Canada. And the epidemiology linkage where our ICPs would ask, well, is this case epidemiologic linked to another case? Two-thirds have a clear epidemiologic link. What does that tell you? That tells you for every VRE case you find in a hospital long-term care facility, we need to do epidemiologic tracing or contact tracing to be sure that we identify those links, because in at least two-thirds of the cases, and perhaps more, you're going to find the other cases that are linked to that, and failure to do so can result in significant problems with spread. And what's the nature of the epidemiologic link? Well, it's sharing a room, sharing a ward, sharing a caregiver, sharing equipment, or sharing a procedure are the major epidemiologic links. The word is share. VRE tends to favor, of course, those who use hospital services, which, of course, is those in the older age range. Fortunately, it's less of a pediatric problem, although that could change. And the VRE infections, as I said, were about 7.6% in the Canadian experience. You can see urinary tract infections and bloodstream infections being the two principal ones, and wound infections and soft tissue and skin infections following behind that. This graph is from the Quality Management Program for Laboratory Services in Ontario that does a wonderful job of external quality assurance in laboratories throughout Ontario. And they track the number of isolates of MRSA in the hatched bars. And you can see the vector is up, up, and away. And for VRE, you can see the number of VRE bacteremias detected in Ontario as well. And in the following graph, you can see the total number of VRE cases to 2006 were over 2,000 per annum in Ontario. And if you break it down by different regions in Ontario, for those of you that don't know Ontario, it's a vast province with the population density being highest in the southern area of the province, as you can see from the map on the left. And the colored region is southeastern Ontario and eastern Ontario, which has got a K postal code. And you can see, again, in all of the jurisdictions, while there's variability, the direction is up. The incidence of VRE infections, well, they usually develop in patients who are colonized with the bacteria in the first instance, and the ratio of infected to colonized patients depends specifically on the patient population. In particular, as I mentioned before, it appears to be highest in hematology and stem cell and organ transplant patients, just the patients in whom we don't want to have this problem. These are the patients who have long-standing dwelling central venous catheters, other tubes, antibiotic exposure, and immune suppression. There is a significant mortality associated with bacteremia due to VRE. The mortality rates for patients with VRE, again, vary by the population, but if you consider autologous peripheral stem cell transplants, people who receive their own bone marrow back, it has a mortality approaching 10%. In those who develop endocarditis due to, say, a central catheter infection, an infection on a heart valve, the mortality with VRE endocarditis is as high as 30%, which is much, much higher than the average. Those with solid tumors who acquire VRE bacteremia have up to a 50% mortality, and in those with liver transplants or otherwise critically ill, not related to liver transplantation, the mortality approaches or exceeds 70%. This organism can be very dangerous. It also has an impact on the length of stay and costs in hospitals. In this study from the Archives of Internal Medicine, although it's over 10 years old, it gives us a general idea of the additional length of stay for VRE versus vancosusceptible enterococcal cases is virtually double, from 17 to 35 days. And hospital costs are highly variable depending on how you calculate them, whether it's charges or direct costs or indirect costs, but you can see almost double as well. Well, this takes us to our local experience in southeastern Ontario with vanco-resistant enterococcus. And before you, you have a week-by-week diagram demonstrating epidemic curve of an outbreak of VRE from May the 1st till the end of December in 2007. And you can see there are two big undulating waves there. It's broken down by color by different inpatient units, which aren't particularly relevant. You can see there's some color dominance there, light blue on the left, which is a medical unit. But you can see how it was quite scattered throughout the organization. And by September and Labor Day, we had thought that we had this licked. However, clearly we did not, and the organism persisted. And we had our emotional reaction would go up and down as the bacteria would go up and down. Indeed, we're almost approaching a year now where we think we believe we finally have control over this. So I guess my message is if you have a VRE outbreak of some significance, you need to be more stubborn. This represents 241 cases, again, mostly colonized, of course. The breakdown by different medical and surgical units, you can see, again, there was a predominance in the medical inpatient units. This caused us to unleash a wide variety of interventions, and I won't discuss the background behind all of them, I'm sure you're aware, but we did institute universal gloving for all patient contact, which causes some controversy in the face of hand hygiene recommendations. We did recommend, of course, hand hygiene before and after putting on your gloves, but we do know that wearing a barrier does prevent transmission. Contact precautions, of course, is a standard of care for all known VRE patients, but we went to the extent of likewise recommending contact precautions for all the potential, that is, the exposed patients or the contact cases of VRE patients, which puts a substantial burden of isolation on a very busy hospital that's over 100% occupied at some points in time. This resulted in us creating an isolation unit in June and then moving that isolation unit for technical reasons to another area of the hospital. But suffice to say that from June until December, we had an isolation unit dedicated to caring for VRE patients exclusively, and it wound down just before Christmas, which we considered our little minor Christmas miracle. We brought about a number of hygiene interventions. We know that enterococci are bowel organisms, and so we paid attention to the disposal and handling of human waste material and recommended and implemented as far as is possible the use of disposable bedpans and urinals and graduating containers that are used to measure urine. And these single-use bedpans and disposable bedpans were also used in isolated patients. And what happens with the bedpans now is they are bagged at the source. No one walks to a bedpan. Nobody sprays out a bedpan. Nobody dumps a bedpan. We put them into a product known as a sani bag, which has a powder inside that coagulates or agglutinates and coagulates and congeals all of the waste contents and helps to contain odor. These bags are large enough that you can put the disposable bedpans inside, tie it off, and they go into waste streams. So the amount of handling of bedpans and any chance of aerosolization and so forth is minimized to the lowest level we think we can achieve. This does present a number of logistical issues. We are still working on rolling all of this out in the hospital because getting the bedpans distributed throughout an organization of this size is a real challenge. We've also lining all of our commode containers with these sani bags, again, for exactly the same reasons. And the acceptance among our frontline healthcare staff has been very gratifying and highly supportive of this. Of course, hand hygiene is a separate topic unto itself. We unleashed every known hand hygiene intervention we could think of with tables with alcohol sanitizer, signage, and putting, of course, it in every patient bedside and so forth. And we also conducted extensive auditing of hand hygiene practices. Environmental services are extremely important in controlling VRE, and this cannot be overstated. We increased the environmental services staffing, effectively doubling it in many areas of the hospital where it was needed, and had extensive interventions to double clean rooms and so forth, and much of that is going to be our new standard of practice. And the reason for that, of course, is not difficult to see. If you look at Kramer's lovely paper in BMC Infectious Diseases, you can see that the three pathogens we all worry about, MRSA, Enterococcus, VRE, and C. difficile, are the ones with the long duration and persistence in the hospital environment lasting weeks to months. And so the role of environmental services is absolutely essential, and we've lived that experience. Other environmental interventions, I actually spent a day as a housekeeper just so that I could say I've seen how the job goes. It's a difficult job, and I have nothing but the deepest respect and regard for my colleagues who work in this area, and they do a job that saves lives, and they need to know that. We went to one toilet brush per room and threw them out after. We didn't want any chance that they were going between rooms. We cleaned our surfaces with a hydrogen peroxide product, which is a Canadian invention. And the rags were not double-dipped, and all of these things that are very common in knowledge, we had to verify that our practices were actually as squeaky clean, as you would say, as possible. Extensive interventions in the form of education were undertaken, and I won't go through all of these, including modern methods of dissemination, podcasts, webcasts, infectious disease rounds, information memos, emails, and so forth were all essential, and it requires extensive effort from one's public relations department, and other details of our information campaign are supplied, and I won't go through all of those except to say that our VRE outbreak committee, you know, up till December had over 60 meetings, and they continue to this day. Well, what about microbial surveillance during the outbreak? We conducted weekly point prevalence surveys. That is, we found that on Sundays and Mondays was the best day to get point prevalence surveys, that is, rectal swabs, on everybody in the hospital on a weekly basis so that we could track the movement of vancomycin-resistant enterococcus. This, of course, requires a Herculean effort to acquire all of the cultures and to process them in the laboratory and report them out and then collate the information in infection control and then communicate it on a weekly basis. Infection control and nursing developed a medical directive, something I highly advise. So you don't need a physician's order for the culture. It's approved by your medical advisory committee or however your hospital operates to allow the nurses to take the specimen when the patient meets the criteria. We also brought in the new chrome agars for vancomycin-resistant enterococci, which improved, and have now gone on to develop our own in-house PCR method, which our validation suggests will give us results in 4 hours. And this is an important aspect of controlling VRE that we have found, that speed is of the essence. The faster you run, the sooner you get there. In other words, if you are chasing VRE cases and it takes you 4 to 5 days to get a lab result, that's not soon enough. Indeed, in my view, I feel that even, you know, 2 days or 3 days with the new agars for VRE may not be fast enough, and faster is better in microbiology. And so our PCR method that will give us results in 4 hours, we think, will make a big difference. We also did molecular typing using repeated sequence PCR. Again, what that is all bacteria have random repeated sequences in their genome, and you can capitalize on that by a PCR method as shown in this cartoon, and you can actually genetically type the organisms, and we did so quite successfully, and this is immeasurably helpful, as we knew we were dealing with one particular clone labeled as A, but as we moved along, the B subtype became more predominant and allowed us to confirm the linkages between patients in the VRE outbreak. Monitoring compliance of the universal gloving contact precautions was conducted, and in the province of Ontario, I'm very proud to say we have a wonderful hand hygiene campaign located at the website www.justcleanyourhands, all one word, .ca, justcleanyourhands.ca, a wonderful website that the Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care in Ontario has developed, a wonderful hand hygiene campaign that's being rolled out. This was fairly new when our outbreak was active, but was something we were able to pick up on. It was extremely helpful. Well, what about going forward? How do we prevent this sort of thing from invading our hospitals, or do we just have to lie down and accept this? I've told you that the bacteria are genetically plastic, have persistence mechanisms. They don't even have to be exposed to antibiotics to maintain themselves. What are we to do? I believe and advocate that active surveillance cultures, in addition to all of the other measures that were put into place, are an important component. I'd like to try to convince you why I think that's the case. A recent paper published in Clinical Infectious Diseases from the University of Maryland demonstrated both a mathematical model that active surveillance in an ICU reduced their VRE transmission by 39%. That's substantial. And a lot of the evidence for active surveillance is been accumulated in MRSA and VRE. And this paper by Huang et al., I highly recommend you pull off and read. If you read anything in the next week, this one will change the way you view things. They used what's known as an interrupted time series design to retrospectively evaluate four sequential interventions in 8 ICUs in their very large institution over a 9-year period. 9 years of observation, that is rarely accomplished. They had 8 critical care areas in a very big teaching hospital, and they brought in 4 interventions, one after the other, not all together. They first went to the use of maximum sterile barriers during the placement of central lines that we all know is a standard of care now. Then they introduced alcohol-based hand rub for hand hygiene, also a standard of care. Then they brought in a hand hygiene promotion campaign. And finally, in sequence, they went to culture-based active surveillance, in this case, for methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. And what they found was that overall in this period, they had a 75% reduction in MRSA bacteremias in their ICU patients. That's a tremendous decrease. But, and the important but, only during the period when the active surveillance for MRSA was implemented did they see a decrease. There was no sustained effect during those periods when any of the other 3 interventions that were serially implemented. There was, interestingly, a concurrent 40% decrease in the incidence of hospital-associated MRSA bacteremia in non-ICU patients, a remarkable spillover effect. These effects resulted overall in, a 67% reduction in MRSA bacteremia in the hospital-wide, 75% reduction in the intensive care unit. Here's an interesting part, though. The incidence of their hospital-acquired methicillin-susceptible Staph aureus, something we don't look at and think about, actually didn't change during the 4 interventional periods at all, because their intervention, particularly the surveillance, was directed at MRSA. Their incidence of new MRSA cases and VRE colonization, which they also measured, decreased during the period when the active surveillance was practiced. And this paper is published in Clinical Infectious Diseases 2006. I highly recommend it. Let's take a look at their graph because it tells the whole story. Starts in January 96, ends in January 05. As you can see, the rate of increase of their MRSA bacteremias was going up from January 96 until such time as they started the maximal sterile central venous catheter placement in October 2000. They then introduced alcohol hand rub. There was no improvement in their MRSA rates between then. And when they introduced the alcohol hand rub, there's a slight drop, but then it shoots up again, and they introduced their hand hygiene campaign. So between alcohol hand rub and hand hygiene campaign, no statistically significant decrease in MRSA bacteremia. Following the hand hygiene campaign, things still didn't improve. Then they bring in MRSA surveillance, and boom, you can see a significant drop in their MRSA rates that was sustained. Interestingly, as a very important control mechanism, it had no impact on the methicillin-susceptible bacteremia rates. And I think this is a good control to tell you that even adding all these interventions one after the other really didn't have an impact. Well, what is our local experience? In Kingston, we had a significant problem, as you can see, with MRSA growing in Ontario as it was, and reaching a peak in the summer, or really the December, excuse me, of 2005, to the extent that we achieved rates, as you can see there, with a significant proportion being infected. We brought in MRSA PCR and a medical directive to allow our nursing staff to take nose cultures on people who had high risk characteristics, that is, had been in a hospital in the last 6 months and so forth. And what we found was, as you can see, is very dramatic. The MRSA rates, and these are total MRSA colonizations and infections, dropped dramatically over the observation period that ends in October of 07, and I can tell you that it's consistently stayed down. What we've also found is that the success of this intervention is directly related to the success in getting the cultures. That is, if you have this program set up and the PCR lab set up and your direct medical directive to allow the cultures to happen, but no one's taking the cultures, it's not going to work. You have to have a compliance monitoring system to assure that these cultures are in fact taken. We learned this during our VRE outbreak, and certainly in the continuing management of MRSA, it is essential to assure at least a 90% compliance. That's what we're striving for, and it's very difficult sometimes to achieve. A 90% compliance in getting these cultures done, because that directly results in improvement. This is similar, of course, to what many countries in Europe have called seek and destroy of both MRSA and VRE. And it's controlled by active detection and then, of course, isolating all of the colonized cases. Long-standing successful control strategies have been achieved by multiple European countries and in the state of Western Australia. And the failure of other European countries and other Australian states that did not routinely use this approach also kind of confirms that this is the right way to go. It's worked at controlling both MRSA and VRE in other countries that have otherwise were failing to control MRSA and VRE. An interesting example published in the New England Journal of Medicine by Ostrowski et al. In 2001 from the Siouxland region, meaning Iowa, Nebraska, and South Dakota, formed a coalition involving active surveillance cultures for VRE and had a prevalence rate of VRE in the 30 participating facilities dropping from 2.2% down to 0.5% back in 1997 through 1999. Likewise, in many of the Western European countries, such as the Netherlands, Belgium, and so forth, have had a very aggressive and sustained policies with active surveillance cultures and preemptive use of contact precautions, and indeed even sometimes closure of entire units, something that's not always easy to accomplish, and such that their control of MRSA is something that we are all aware of and should pay attention to. You know, mathematical modeling, where modelers look at MRSA and VRE transmission dynamics, also support this, that in comparison to conventional culture methods that take several days, the use of a rapid detection method decreases the isolation needs in settings of low endemicity and result in more rapid reduction in the prevalence in highly endemic settings. And that's clearly our local experience for MRSA and VRE. What about the hospital environment? Let's return to that for a moment as a way to go forward and prevent the transmission. This is a very interesting quasi-experimental observational study. They found that their intervention, which was to actually physically watch housekeepers and audit them using a checklist to say, you know, of the 100 things you should have touched and cleaned, you missed 20, and therefore your success rate is 80%. It was done in a very supportive and in a very positive way, because remember, our housekeepers save lives. And they found that by doing this, Hayden et al., that by doing this audit, they had a twofold increase in the number of sites that were actually cleaned according to the protocol. And you can see this in their graph here, demonstrating in different periods how the percent of patients colonized with VRE drops consistently with this intervention. But what about the environment? Is there anything else that we can do? For example, is a private room safer? Now, if you come to the CHICA annual meeting that will be held in Montreal in June, in Montreal, I'll be presenting this as a poster. But here's just a sampler. We examined our admissions between 2001 and 2005 and found that 37,418 patients had 242 roommates. What does this mean? That means that every day you will meet 1.9 new people, two new roommates per day during your stay in an average teaching hospital in southern Canada. By using a stepwise regression model and a Cox proportional hazards model, we were able to demonstrate that your hazards ratio, that is your increased risk of acquiring MRSA related to your number of daily roommates, is 1.06, meaning that you have a 6% increased rate of acquiring MRSA per roommate. Think about that for a minute. Being in a private room is safer. And, of course, this is a lovely picture from Dr. Hayden demonstrating all of the cross-contaminated surfaces in a critical care area where all the little stars are, where they have found VRE-positive cultures, and it's absolutely everywhere, speaking to the importance of environmental hygiene, speaking to the importance of isolation, the controlling of the use of stool, active surveillance cultures, and controlling the movement. But of all of the things that we can do, active surveillance cultures is something that we really, really need to invest in. So what can I summarize? Well, many of my physician colleagues will say, but I can go into an isolation room without wearing a gown and glove, right, if I don't touch anything. No, not quite. And we have to very much enforce the adherence to contact precautions. And, oh, but my hands are okay, is something that we're working very hard to convince people otherwise. And so what I learned in kindergarten that helped me deal with a large VRE outbreak is that cleaning your hands is really very, very important, that poo is yucky and it transmits disease, and inside our bowels exist many virulent organisms with phenomenal genetic plasticity, and that keeping things clean is really very important. And perhaps also running faster is better, because you'll be more likely to win the prize. So, Paul, that concludes my comments, and I'm happy to entertain any discussion if we have any time left.
Thank you, Dick. We do have time left, and I think you are the only person to ever say in a teleclass that poo is yucky. You may be the only person to ever use the word poo in a scientific teleclass. I thank you for it.
You can quote me anytime.
I'm going to open the line for questions in just a moment, but I want to point out just quickly that there were a couple of brand names of products mentioned during the course of this teleclass, and of course, teleclass education doesn't endorse or support any particular brand or company, and such mention should not be taken as such. Dick, there was an article you might have seen in the Journal of Hospital Infection a couple of months ago. I think it was Carney and colleagues in Boston. They did a study of several hospitals in their area, and they artificially inoculated certain surfaces in the intensive care units. And they found that in 50% of the intensive care units, these were like bed rails and different things, those surfaces weren't cleaned at all. And in another 25% of them, they were cleaned only 50% of the time, that sort of thing. So the housekeeping, where the budgets get cut constantly, I think you're right. That is a remarkably important place. If they don't have time to clean them, they're not going to get cleaned, right?
Absolutely. I mean, in my day as an environmental services employee, it was the hardest day of work. I went home, went to bed. The cleaning and intensive care unit room, where there's all this technology and intravenous medication pumps and cables and so forth, is a huge challenge. And the people I was working with take this challenge very, very seriously. But there are real capacity issues. And so there's also the issue of what is the best way to clean. We know we have issues with Clostridium difficile, and you've had very excellent teleclasses discussing that point. But clearly this is something that requires more study and more investigation, because we can't make assumptions about the hygiene in our hospitals. It's just not safe.
Can you catch VRE when you're sleeping?
Depends what you're doing. And who's next to you, I suppose. Not going any further with that, I think VRE... patients acquire it when they're asleep in hospital, but so sure. I mean, it depends who's touching you and what's going on around you.
With regards to active surveillance, how do you handle patient refusals, consent, that sort of thing? Your patient that comes through your doors that perhaps is confused and you can't really inform them what the screening is all about. Is this considered standard of care and therefore you proceed and just do your active surveillance? What is your protocol?
Yes, we want to have the patient's consent. You know, obviously, nursing procedures and bedside procedures there's general consent in that we feel, and I'm not an expert, but we feel that the general consent to be admitted and to have the normal procedures of a hospital are covered off in that. If a patient can't give that general consent, obviously we seek consent from a substitute decision maker, just like we would for other things. And we do not have a specific consent form, for example, for this procedure. The professional practice, of course, is for the person collecting the specimen to inform the patient what they're doing and to get their consent. If a patient refuses, who is, able to, express that, we obviously then the patients have the right to refuse their medications, their treatments, and the surveillance cultures. That hasn't been our experience to be very common, though.
Would you isolate those patients with the idea that if they did refuse, that you would consider them positive?
Well, again, it hasn't been a major problem. However, if it did happen, I think we would look at the risk profile, and if we felt that they had been exposed and were at high risk, and the other thing, of course, is you can use a stool specimen. I'd have a hard time imagining patients refusing to allow us to process a stool specimen for VRE culture.
True. So with regards, again, just so that I'm clear, with those regards to those patients who are confused, you would go to a decision maker prior to doing screening?
Again, I'm not a hospital ethics or expert, but my understanding is that general consent, upon admission to a facility would cover this off, or if that general consent is provided by a substitute decision maker. But I would encourage you then, if you had queries, to check, with your privacy and advisor and your ethical advisors for your hospitals and your risk management. Make sure that you're consistent with the best practice in that regard.
Thank you so much.
I wondered about this clonal complex 17. You introduced it at the beginning of the lecture, and I'm sorry if I missed some of the implications of that. But has it been described as a more virulent VRE, and do you know if that's the strain you were dealing with in your outbreak?
I don't know for sure if it's clonal complex 17. We're still going to work on that, but I expect so. Virulence, enterococci are not among the most virulent pathogens. Staph aureus is considered to be far more disease-producing. However, the clonal complex 17 tend to be collecting virulence genes, like the ESP gene I talked about, so they have the potential to be perhaps more virulent. I think we need more study on that. However, there is no doubt that they are very fit to multiply and grow in the hospital environment, and that is, of course, frightening, because that means that that explains in large measure or in a significant measure, the amount of VRE that we are seeing and the continuous growth of the VRE. As a microbiologist, I marvel at the capacity of microbes to adapt to their immediate environmental needs. You know, it'd be akin to all of us in the face of a shortage of oil suddenly going to a whole new mechanism of fueling our cars overnight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that's the equivalent in my mind. Hard to imagine.
So it has implications for the incidence and prevalence of VRE, and the virulence is we're still determining if that has a significant impact.
Yes, and of course the persistence, because antimicrobial exposure, while initially may have been important, may be less important now.
Right. Thank you.
And I have a question regarding screening patients while they're on antibiotics. This would be for MRSA and for VRE.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have an exclusionary process for that?
No. If they're on antibiotics, we don't exclude or include. We actually just take the specimen, and in our surveillance, we may note that they were on antibiotics, but we don't use that in decision making about doing surveillance, active surveillance cultures.
Now, I've got a question. I wondered if you're seeing an increased incidence of VRE positive people coming in from the community. And did your numbers, when you talked about your year-long outbreak there last year, did that include all cases or just nosocomial cases?
We focused on nosocomial cases. This was a nosocomial event. VRE in the community, there's a fascinating subject that needs some study. We, of course, in our region are semi-urban, and so we have a lot of referral community hospitals who and people who come back to our hospital as the major tertiary center. And so as a result, we generated a community of patients with VRE who then kept getting readmitted. Our epidemiologic surveillance of each case, we were able to link most of the cases back to, hospital exposure either in our region or to us directly. So the amount of community MRSA based on that process, which isn't perfect, suggests that it's not a common event. Now, the other way is to start testing people in the community. I'm not aware that it's been found very often, but I would like to be corrected if I'm wrong.
I just have one closing question, Dr. Sedman. Is it possible to get to zero colonization, zero infections?
Yes, I'm absolutely convinced that it's possible. I think it's not only possible but necessary. The scourge of these infections and the cost of these infections to, the patients that we serve is just not acceptable. It's a matter of scaling our effort and our research to meet the need. But I'm convinced, although while these organisms have mighty genetic plasticity, I believe we can overcome it, but we have to stay on top of it, and we have to be ahead of it and not behind where the organism has been. We need to be ahead of where it's going.
Thank you very much to all of you for joining our teleclass today. And Dr. Zoubman, again, this is, I think, your third teleclass, and they get more interesting every time. I thank you very much for doing this.
You're very welcome, Paul. My pleasure indeed.
Until we meet again, everyone, goodbye.